Welcome to Oncology Today, a special follow-up program to two recent CME satellite meetings at the Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium in San Francisco. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with one of the faculty members from the Hepatocellular Cancer and Biliary Tract Cancer Symposium, Dr. Lipita Goyal from the Stanford University School of Medicine in Palo Alto, California. To begin, I asked Dr. Goyal to comment on her current approach to first-line systemic therapy of patients with advanced hepatocellular carcinoma.
We're excited that we have multiple options now for HCC, so atezolizumab and bevacizumab, with the IMbrave 150 study, and then the durvalumab plus tremelimumab regimen from the Himalaya study. Then, of course, we always have the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, lenvatinib and sorafenib, which have longstanding been available for patients. So, you know, given atezolizumab plus bevacizumab has a VEGF inhibitor as part of the regimen, I always think to myself, do patients have any relative contraindications to getting a VEGF inhibitor? So I find that if people have had recent significant bleeding, I think about whether or not it's safe to give them a VEGF inhibitor. If people have at baseline relatively uncontrolled hypertension, despite, for example, three antihypertensives, and I worry about them developing further hypertension on the VEGF inhibitor, I think twice about that regimen. If people have significant proteinuria at baseline, that's hard to get on top of, I think about that. Also, of course, you know, in our population, we see people with varices. And so if people have varices that can be treated and, you know, can move forward with the atezo-bev, that's my first choice. But if they have, let's say, grade 3 varices and we ban them and they're going to take some more time in order for it to be safe for them, for the patient to be treated, but the patient is having pain, for example, and more urgently needs to start on therapy, that's the kind of patient that I would, you know, treat the varices because I want to be able to give them a VEGF inhibitor in the future. But it might make sense to start with durvalumab and tremelimumab up front.
Have you used that regimen, the STRIDE regimen?
I have used it. I have used it and certainly had success with it. I will say that, you know, as reported in the trial, there was a 20% rate of immune-related adverse events requiring steroids. When I have used it, I've had some patients requiring steroids for it. So certainly patients who go on it need to be, you know, robust enough to be able to manage the adverse events that can sometimes come with the regimen. But that goes for all of our regimens, including atezo-bev, lenvatinib, sorafenib. We want to make sure that if they had a complication, that we're able to certainly help them through that.
Well, I guess that is one of the big questions that oncologists have in their most of their experience with anti-CTLA-4 is ipilimumab, ipi-nivo. My understanding, though, is in general, I don't know if this is just in general ipi-nivo or more in HCC or, you know, GI cancers, that the number you just brought up, the incidence of, you know, requiring steroids for autoimmune toxicity is much higher, more in the range of 50%. Clinically, do you feel like it is less, causes less immune problems than, for example, ipi-nivo?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was around 50% in the trial for ipi-nivo and HCC. And so I do find that durva plus tremi, people end up having less immune-related adverse events with it. And it's a little gentler for some patients. We're really excited that we have both of those options. You know, we look forward to seeing the results of the frontline ipi-nivo study to see if that becomes another frontline option. That's the, you know, yeah. So we look forward to seeing like the frontline study results.
So there's a trial looking at ipi-nivo up front?
Yeah, it's ipi-nivo versus dealer's choice sorafenib and lenvatinib.
That's really interesting. You were mentioning the issue of VEGF inhibitors and, you know, contraindications. What about just the issue of people who are older, frail, and who have, maybe have some, you know, history of heart disease? Is that, you know, I've never been exactly clear whether Bev actually has an adverse effect on those patients. Some people say they do. I don't know. Does that cause you hesitation in using atezo-bev?
You know, generally speaking, I find it to be a relatively well-tolerated regimen. So age doesn't come into play for me when giving atezo-bev. You know, if someone has, you know, advanced heart failure, for example, it might be a patient that I am less likely to use Bevan. But even some people who have coronary artery disease, even if someone has a history of a CABG, you know, I think it's still reasonable to give atezo-bev. It's such an active regimen that, and HCC is such a deadly disease that given the cost-benefit analysis, of course, with informed consent with the patient, I think it's still reasonable to proceed.
So for patients who don't have any relative contraindications, I'm curious, as you know, most people are at this point staying with atezo-bev, but just kind of curious, you know, when you think about that in terms of, again, any thoughts about why you might want to choose one versus the other in a patient who doesn't have a contraindication? Any advantage, anything in the data that makes you think one would be better, or are they at this point kind of like from the point of view of efficacy seem very similar to you? You know, you mentioned you were telling me about a program you did with Dr. Abu Alpha, and he's one of the few docs who, of course, he was the PI of the Himalaya study, but he's very pro, you know, stride regimen. Not most other people kind of more like in your camp. But any thoughts about his thinking that maybe it's a better regimen?
Yeah, you know, of course, there's always the pitfalls of doing cross-trial comparison because the populations were not exactly the same. So, for example, in the atezo-bev study, they allowed patients with main portal vein thrombosis or VP4 disease. And in the Himalaya study, patients with main portal vein thrombosis were not allowed. So it's not totally the exact same population. But of course, you know, we do what we can with the data. And you know, the median overall survival, which was the primary endpoint in the IMbrave 150 study, with atezo-bev, the median survival was 19.2 months. In the Himalaya study, the median survival was a little over 16 months with the combination of durva and tremi. And so, you know, the patients in the atezo-bev study, the sorafenib arm did better. They lived around 16 months plus. And in the durva-tremi study, the sorafenib arm, they lived 13.8 months. And so, again, that just shows that it's not quite an apples-to-apples comparison. So if we did it head-to-head, it's hard to know if one would win versus the other. But I think they both have their place in the treatment of HCC. And then, of course, you know, the Himalaya team did the landmark analysis where they looked at what the survival was sort of long-term. And that certainly looked quite favorable for durva and tremi. And we don't know what the long-term survival in the same way. There was not a landmark analysis for the IMbrave 150 study.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have come out, you know, thinking that, you know, maybe combination immunotherapy might have a longer term, but we're doing a program on renal cell cancer and they have this big argument about whether to use ipi-nivo or IO-TKI. But there, you know, the hope that maybe you'll see longer-term responses with combination immunotherapy. One of the things I want to do as we chat today also is reflect back on some of the questions that came out in the symposium from the docs, the general oncologists who presented cases, because a lot of the questions, you know, were dealt with fairly briefly, and you know, there were a bunch of issues that I wanted to just bring back up, and you may remember some of these questions that came up. One was the issue of whether or not, you know, maybe these new systemic therapies should be maybe given ahead of interventional radiology procedures. You know, one of the things you hear from a lot of oncologists is that by the time sometimes they don't see the patient until they've already had interventional radiology. Sometimes they've had a lot of it and maybe not that a great condition for systemic therapy. Have you found yourself that you're, of course, they don't have the kind of interdisciplinary team that you see at tertiary centers. Do you, but in the tertiary setting, do you think there's been less intervention or more delayed local intervention in the liver because now there are these therapies that cause responses?
I think that's a great question, and you're hitting on a very key question that's relevant in the field right now. And you also made the great point about multidisciplinary clinics. So now we have so many options, both for localized disease and for systemic disease, that it really makes sense to bring all of these cases to be presented with a team of interventional radiologists, radiation oncologists, transplant surgeons, hepatobiliary surgeons, and medical oncologists. And of course, our radiologists and pathologists who help us make the diagnosis and think about these patients. I think having a group discussion helps us think best about the patient. And oftentimes, it's not one or the other. It's what now versus what later. You know, we might often start with one, for example, TACE or Y90, and then on the heels of that, end up coming in with systemic therapy. Or we might start with systemic therapy because maybe someone has a large portal vein thrombosis that we want to address on the sooner side. And then if they get a good response to atezo-bev, sometimes we might follow that or consolidate with some local regional therapy. And so a lot of it is just trying to figure out what do we start with first. What I will say is that for the first 10 years when I took care of HCC and we only had sorafenib, I was more likely to push localized therapy for longer because I knew sorafenib was tough. I knew the efficacy was modest. And now that we have atezo-bev, I think there is a feeling among multi-clinics that take care of HCC that we don't want to beat up the liver too much because if people develop Child Pugh B cirrhosis, it becomes harder to deliver systemic therapy. And so that's why having a close relationship with the interventional radiologist and the radiation oncologist, you know, what I love about localized therapy is that it's effective and gives people a good quality of life without having to come see me back and forth in clinic every 3 weeks, you know? So if, you know, one of our IR docs can do Y90 and they get 9 months without having to feel like a patient all the time, that's a win-win for everybody. But then if we start hitting some of the normal liver along with the tumor, because of course these patients have liver disease in the background, often have some cirrhosis or at least a component of fibrosis. If we start taking out some normal liver and then we prevent giving them effective therapies, you know, that's not the best option either. So it's a conversation that we all work together to help them.
It's funny when you said when we just had sorafenib alone, I was sort of flashing back when we used to do CME programs, then I was like, what are we going to talk about, you know? And all we had to talk about was sorafenib. Then lenvatinib came along. Okay, that was a little bit better. And then boom, everything exploded. And now you can't even get through it in an hour. One of the other questions that came up, you know, it's funny. It wasn't that long ago that we were just talking about. I mean,
right,
what, five years ago?
It's been the last 5 or 6 years that we went from having one drug to having like 8 or 9 regimens that are approved.
I love to ask on our webinars, what fraction of you have been in oncology less than 5 years? And usually like 25, 30% of people, and they have no idea how different things are nowadays.
The Another barren question landscape that we had for so many years, yeah.
Right, right. Another question that came out at the webinar, I just wanted to bring it back up to you, is, you know, there was always this sort of classic question of whether or not you need to biopsy somebody who has obvious HCC and high alpha fetoprotein protein. And one of the docs, you may remember, brought up the issue of whether or not you need to biopsy just to get tissue for genomic assay, and whether or not from a practical point of view, yes, sure, clinical trials, you know, that's possible. But from a practical point of view, do you see any role of getting tissue in HCC for genomic or other assays?
You know, luckily HCC is, I think, one of the only solid tumors that you can diagnose radiographically, and we're glad that that's an option. My own personal practice is in patients with early stage HCC that I'm thinking about transplant in or resection in, and they meet the criteria for radiological diagnosis, including having a background underlying cirrhosis, plus the radiological features of early arterial enhancement and delayed venous washout, and a pseudocapsule, at least two of those three, if they're greater than 2 centimeters. I tend to hold off on biopsy in some of those patients. Any person that I'm putting on systemic therapy, I try to biopsy 100% of those patients, because every once in a while we get surprised and a patient has cholangiocarcinoma, or they have a mixed hepatocellular cholangiocarcinoma, or they have some other diagnosis, you know? And so we're not giving people Kool-Aid, and these treatments can have side effects. So it's really about the recipe in medical oncology, getting that right for whatever histology it is. So, and I also feel that if we're going to make advancements in HCC, having that tissue to start to develop biomarkers to figure out when we have all these frontline regimens, atezo-bev, durva-tremi, lenvatinib, sorafenib, who should we be putting towards each of these different regimens? Because they all have a response rate somewhere between 20 and 30%, you know? And so there's probably certain populations of patients that respond better to one or the other. Now, there's that age-old question about where does patient care and research, where do they all fit in together, you know? I certainly think when we're doing clinical trials and we're testing new drugs, I think having a biopsy at baseline and sending that tissue to the company or doing, you know, studies within the institution to try to identify biomarkers, I think everyone wins when you do that. Because ultimately, we know in HCC, about 50% of patients, or even maybe more, are not going to make it to plan B. You know, after plan A, a lot of people don't make it to plan B. And I'm not talking just about the trial population, because those patients are obviously a bit fitter. So it really is incumbent upon us as an oncology community to try to get it right the first time as much as possible. And so if we're able to match people with an effective first-line therapy to begin with, I think we stand to have better outcomes for patients.
Actually, as I was asking that, I was just sort of flashing on, I don't know whether this is an issue with HCC, but you hear it in almost every solid tumor, which is tumor-informed ctDNA. Has that been looked at? I mean, theoretically, you would need tissue for that. Do you see that with a future with HCC?
You know, there's certainly studies that are coming out looking at ctDNA in diagnosis of HCC and disease monitoring for HCC and understanding resistance to HCC. There have been a series of genomic profiling studies also for HCC to figure out what kind of therapies we should be giving patients. I think it's all a work in progress right now. You know, there are a paucity of biomarker-directed HCC studies. You know, some of the studies are around using, for FGFR4 inhibitors, for example, using FGF19 overexpression or amplification as a biomarker. But most trials in HCC are biomarker unselected. I think the more we learn through ctDNA and genomic profiling and the more drug development that we do in a variety of cancers, I think we're going to have more matched therapies, hopefully, in the future for HCC. But right now, the use of ctDNA is more on the research side, more so than on the mainstream clinical side.
So another issue related to choice of first-line therapy in HCC, you know, there's been a long-standing issue, and you know, it's been looked at so many times, whether or not there's a difference in the underlying etiologic factor, particularly viral versus non-viral, and response to therapy. And for a long time, I wasn't hearing anything about that. And then it seems now we're starting to hear more things, particularly with the non-viral, maybe not responding as much to immunotherapy. When I can't remember who was, I asked an investigator about Himalaya, and she said, I think about it in NASH, when people have a little bit of heart disease, you know, there's a little bit of contraindication of Bev, and, you know, a little bit of maybe they're not going to respond as well. What do you think about the emerging data? I guess there's no definitive data at this point, but do you think we're going to find out that there is a difference in response? I mean, kind of, you would think it might make sense, viral versus non-viral. Any thoughts about that whole debate?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we talk about in the HCC community. What I would say is, I think we need to be careful about subgroup analyses. I think subgroup analyses are really valuable because they generate hypotheses, but I try not to dictate my practice through subgroup analyses because they're just not powered to show us what we're looking at, you know? So you're right, there have been some questions around how much patients with NASH respond to immunotherapy, but I would say there are not prospective definitive data showing efficacy of the regimen in one population versus the other. So for now, my personal practice is to treat everybody regardless of etiology. With, you know, an immunotherapy regimen up front, specifically with atezo-bev if they're candidates, otherwise with durva-tremi if they're not candidates. And there are a lot of really smart groups trying to assess the impact of etiology on outcomes now.
Any situations where you use single-agent IO as first-line therapy?
Yeah, certainly. So if someone has a relative contraindication to bevacizumab. And if I'm worried about the ability of that patient to tolerate immune-related adverse events, you know, the initial 300 milligram dose of tremelimumab, that CTLA-4 antibody can add, you know, a bit more immune-related toxicity compared to, for example, durvalumab alone. So in patients who are a bit older, frailer, and, you know, I actually also look at what kind of social support a patient has, because when patients develop immune-related adverse events, they need help. They need their family or their friends or someone who's going to, you know, be able to recognize, oh, this person's having grade 3 diarrhea, or they're having grade 3 shortness of breath, you know, bringing them into the hospital. And then it's a long road afterwards of steroids and, you know, sort of micromanaging that care. And so how much partnership do I have with the patient's family and friends to be able to manage that patient? To be honest, that goes into my calculus as well for giving them doublet therapy upfront versus singlet immunotherapy. And then for, you know, upfront systemic therapy, we certainly have the data for durvalumab. We have data for, you know, we can consider pembrolizumab, nivolumab, you know, all of these are reasonable options.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't know. When I first saw Himalaya, I thought the durvalumab alone arm wasn't that bad. I mean, maybe, you know, it's better than sorafenib, I think. That's what it looked like. Is that your take?
Yeah, you know, if you look at the numbers, they look very good for durvalumab. And it was powered to look at non-inferiority to sorafenib rather than superiority to sorafenib.
Right.
So hence, we tend to, you know, favor using durva-tremi as opposed to durva alone. But as, you know, you were just asking, there's certainly a population for patients who would benefit from durva alone. And it was encouraging that, you know, the efficacy looked similar to durva-tremi in many respects.
So I don't know if you remember, but one of the cases that one of the docs presented was a patient who'd had a transplant and now had recurrent advanced disease. And he did not want to give the patient an IO, understandably. And at that point had not, I think the patient had already had three different TKIs. I think it was lenvatinib and cabo and regorafenib, I think. But I am curious, in patients with relative or really absolute contraindications to IOs, how do you sequence the TKIs?
I generally think of lenvatinib and sorafenib. I think they're both good options. You know, lenvatinib is generally a therapy that I often will go to because of the higher response rate and the encouraging data also that just came out of the frontline study of lenvatinib pembro versus lenvatinib. You know, the overall survival with lenvatinib was impressive.
What's the initial dose that you use of lenvatinib?
I tend to use 12 milligrams in patients who are more than 60 kgs. And I tend to use 8 milligrams in people that are less than 60 kgs. If someone is a little older and frailer, even if they're more than 60 kgs, I might start with 8.
And can you talk a little bit about how you approach second and third line therapy in patients who get either atezo-bev, I guess that's a more common first line therapy, or tremi-durva?
I'll often think about using lenvatinib or sorafenib. I think it's also very reasonable to consider using cabozantinib or using ipi-nivo in that setting. I think all four of those are reasonable regimens. The jury's not out yet on, you know, which one of these might be the most effective after atezo-bev. My first inclination is always, do I have a clinical trial for this patient? And if I don't have a clinical trial, then the four of those are options.
In general, how do you think through the issue of patients who have relative contraindications to IOs? This comes up, you know, in every tumor where we see people using checkpoint inhibitors. You have the issue of transplant, as we were talking about, not just hepatic transplant, but, you know, some occasionally see people who've had renal transplants. And then, of course, the whole spectrum of prior autoimmune disease, everything from, you know, history of ulcerative colitis, you know, multiple sclerosis, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about how you think through that question of whether to use an IO in somebody who has one of these contraindications or relative contraindications?
Yeah, you know, given immunotherapy is so effective in, relatively speaking, in HCC, I try to do my very best to use it whenever I can, and I will phone a friend if we need help from gastroenterology or pulmonology, for example. So people who have a history of Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, and if they haven't had a flare-up in a long period of time, certainly I will consider giving atezo-bev in that setting, and then, you know, keep close contact with their Crohn's doctor. Even if they have had a recent flare, again, given the effectiveness of these regimens, we can sometimes give adjunctive therapies that can help manage the Crohn's while we're giving immunotherapy. So before I say no to immunotherapy, I will often touch base with their doctor that takes care of their autoimmune disease to see, you know, how severe is this really, and what are our step-up therapies if someone were to have a flare? How dangerous would it be for this patient? You know, so, you know, make that decision collaboratively with their other primary doctors. When it comes to transplant, you know, certainly we need to be quite cautious. You know, the rejection rate post-transplant in the setting of immunotherapy is, you know, 50% or greater. So it's not my go-to. I'll certainly use the tyrosine kinase inhibitors as my first options. One of the key things to think about when you're giving TKIs after transplant is you need to make sure they do not interact with the immunosuppressants. And so people are often on tacrolimus, sirolimus, they're often on mycophenolate mofetil. Those drugs can sometimes interact with some of the TKIs, so looking for drug-drug interactions is important. But I will often use lenvatinib or sorafenib or cabozantinib, and now recently there was some data on ramucirumab post-transplant. So I think those are all reasonable options. I don't say no to immunotherapy outright in patients with transplant. One, I think if we have a trial, we can study it safely. I think that's the best option. But of course, those trials are few and far between, so many centers don't have them. I think it's reasonable if we've exhausted all the TKIs with a very careful discussion about the risks and benefits and a very careful discussion with their transplant team, with plans for, you know, managing the immunosuppression if they develop rejection and managing the levels of their immunosuppressants along the way and having that conversation collectively with the transplant team and them. I think if there's informed consent, I think it's not unreasonable to consider in very select patients.
So just one more question, then we'll get on to biliary. And I was just kind of, I kind of jotted this down when, in the beginning when we were talking about adjuvant and you mentioned screening. I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about the issue. It's kind of an issue I, you know, hear a little bit about in on and off over the years, but now I wonder with these adjuvant data whether it's going to be even more important. And that's the issue of screening for HCC, and particularly the issue of the oncologist being aware of that. I've heard stories about oncologists seeing patients for like hypersplenism and, you know, not using that as an, you know, they see the patient goes to thrombocytopenic, but not realizing that's an opportunity to make sure the patient's getting screened. So I don't know that oncologists are that tuned into the whole screening thing. But can you just kind of bring us up to date on kind of how you think through screening and what we know about to what extent it's being effectively done?
Yeah, you know, you're right that I don't think it's on the radar of most oncologists, because if people are seeing people for hypersplenism, that's often on the hematology side, or, you know, it's not usually the GI oncologists that are managing the hypersplenism. I do think you're right that the vast majority of patients that are getting screened are being screened by their primary care doctors, or if they're plugged into a hepatologist or gastroenterologist, then plugged in. You know, for Hep B, Hep C, patients who have cirrhosis, we have much better screening guidelines for doing ultrasound every 6 months. And sometimes we alternate ultrasound and MRI, depending on how high risk someone is. I think that the gap that we all talk about in screening is the patients with fatty liver disease and NASH who do not have cirrhosis. As we know that there's a population of patients with hepatitis B and a population of patients with NAFLD and NASH that can get to cirrhosis, I mean, can get to HCC without going through cirrhosis. But the number of patients with NAFLD and NASH without cirrhosis is so high that trying to find a cost-effective way to figure out which of those patients are high risk and screen as opposed to screening all several million patients with NAFLD and NASH, I think that's going to be part of the holy grail. You know, I wish there were blood tests that we could do to identify who are the patients with high risk NASH or NAFLD for conversion to HCC, not conversion, but for development of HCC. But we are not there yet. Even better than that, I wish we had treatments for NASH and NAFLD beyond what we normally do right now, which is, you know, treating the hypercholesterolism and treating the diabetes and treating the obesity with, you know, diet and exercise. I think NAFLD and NASH treatments, there's a lot of research going on in this area and there are drugs that are coming out. But I think if we want to prevent HCC, I think just the way we have made great strides with treating hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and that's led to a decrease in the development of HCC. I think if we can make those strides with NASH and NAFLD, I think that will be real progress.
Right now, about what fraction of HCC in the United States is non-viral?
That's a great question. What I will say is the dominant causes of HCC in the U.S. are hepatitis C, alcoholism, and NASH / NAFLD. It varies by region. So, for example, in Texas, there's a fair number of patients with NASH and NAFLD-related HCC. In the West Coast, there are a lot of patients from Asia, and you see more hepatitis B related HCC in addition to hep C and alcohol related HCC. So I would say that it varies by region in the US.
So one other thing I want to ask you about is a recent press release on an adjuvant study with HCC, the EMBRAVE 050 trial.
We were really encouraged to see that press release. I think ultimately we'll have to see what the data looked like to get a sense of how positive the study was. But yeah, that was the EMBRAVE 050 study. And that was patients who had high-risk hepatocellular carcinoma who underwent curative resection or ablation. They were randomized to either getting adjuvant atezolizumab plus bevacizumab or to observation. And people got treated for a year. And it looks like from the press release that it was a positive study. We'll see in the end what the data look like, but the recurrence rate after resection for HCC is around 70-80%, depending, of course, on how what kind of features people have on their tumor. And even after ablation, there's a reasonably high recurrence rate for having new HCCs or a recurrence within the ablation zone. And so there's definitely a need to decrease rates of recurrence and increase rates of cure. So given atezo-bev is a reasonably tolerated regimen, we're excited to see if this is going to be the new standard.
So let's talk a little bit about biliary tract cancers. And before we get into first-line therapy, I just want to bring up something you mentioned earlier, which is a sort of mixed tumor where it's like, you know, biliary tract and HCC. How often do you see that and how do you manage those patients? I didn't even know it existed until I heard a case. And I'm like, whoa, what do you do?
Yeah, our pathologists are very smart and thorough people, and they will often pick up, not often, they will rarely pick up a small component of HCC in a sea of cholangio or a component of cholangio in a sea of HCC. And sometimes it's more mixed and sometimes it's just a small component of it. I don't see it that often. You know, I will say that in the cases that I see, I've probably seen about 10 to 15 cases in the past 10 years, you know? So I don't see it all that often, but it's certainly a real entity, you know, for a long time, because we had sorafenib for HCC and we had GemCis for cholangio. You know, we were treating a lot of it like cholangio and giving a lot of GemCis. Now that we have atezo-bev, you know, we're using more atezo-bev for patients. I kind of take a cue from our pathologist to get a sense of, is it dominantly HCC or dominantly cholangio? Because we have reasonable frontline regimens for both cancers, you know? So, and then I look at, you know, the CA19-9 and the AFP and, you know, the overall radiographic features. And then we make a overall assessment about what's the best way to approach. And of course, the side effects of the different treatments that we would be giving, and does anybody have any relative contraindications to immunotherapy or a VEGF inhibitor? So all of those factors go into deciding what to treat with.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of sort of the anatomy of biliary tract cancer? And also, and I think this is one of the questions one of the oncologists had, because we're going to get into this issue of first-line therapy and, of course, the TOPAZ study, whether or not you see differences in response to systemic therapy based on the systemic, on the location or the type of biliary tract cancer. You were talking about subset analysis, so I know they look at these things, but then again, it's a subset analysis. Are there any sort of themes that come through in terms of, for example, sensitivity to IOs or any other issues in terms of sort of the location?
Yeah, so for a long time, we've thought about biliary tract cancer along these anatomic subtypes. So intrahepatic, which involves the bile duct involving the radicals beyond the left and right hepatic ducts. Then extrahepatic cholangio, which involves the left and right hepatic ducts. The perihilar region, where those tumors are called Klatskin's tumors. And then the bile duct. And then sort of distal bile duct cancer also is one of the extrahepatic tumors, and that involves, you know, the distal bile duct and the mid-CBD. And then there's gallbladder cancer and ampullary cancer. And this is the way we should think about biliary tract cancer. And now, with the advent of next-generation sequencing, we've now sort of bucketed these tumors a little bit differently. And while we still are mindful of the anatomic subset, we also think about what are their molecular features. In terms of response to systemic therapy, you know, really interestingly, you probably saw at GI ASCO this year that the results of the SWOG 1815 study were released by Dr. Ruchna Shroff, and that was the phase 3 study of gemcitabine, cisplatin, and nab-paclitaxel compared to gemcitabine, cisplatin. And remarkably, while that was a negative study, it did show that the patients with gallbladder cancer did quite well on the triple regimen. And I think that needs to be, you know, further explored. But it's interesting that, you know, in a gallbladder cancer is usually the disease site where those patients have, unfortunately, the worst prognosis. And the fact that they had sort of the best outcomes on that trial was certainly interesting. I think that overall with the immunotherapies, the different subsets are all seeing responses across the different subsets. I think we can do more biomarker analysis to try to understand who are going to be the responders and the non-responders to the combination of GemCis plus Durva and GemCis plus Pembro. As I'm sure you saw the press release from Merck showing that the GemCis plus Pembro compared to GemCis alone, that frontline study was also positive.
So I guess so we'll have to see how that data indirectly compares to the TOPAZ study and see how people are going to process that. Any comments, though, on currently the way you think through first-line therapy and any other comments about the study that you mentioned that was presented with a GemCis nab-paclitaxel and whether or not there's a role for that at this time, what your thoughts are about the TOPAZ study? And, you know, I hear people saying that's the new standard of care, whether you agree with that or not.
Yeah, we're encouraged that after 10 years, more than 10 years, we have finally another positive study that, you know, showed improved survival compared to gemcitabine cisplatin. So just for your audience, the TOPAZ-1 study was a global phase 3 study of durvalumab plus gemcitabine cisplatin paired to gemcitabine cisplatin in patients with advanced biliary tract cancers. And in that study, the patients in the durvalumab and gemcitabine cisplatin arm had an overall survival, median overall survival of 12.8 months compared to the placebo plus gemcitabine cisplatin arm. They had an overall median overall survival of 11.5 months. And this was encouraging because also the 24-month overall survival was 25% versus 10% in the triplet arm versus the doublet arm. Again, you know, this landmark analysis was helpful for us to think about the benefits of immunotherapy long term. And so those were what the data looked like, and that was really encouraging. And do I believe that it's a new standard? I do believe that it's a new standard. I think one of the questions about it was the overall survival benefit driven by the Asian population? Again, looking at the subgroup analyses. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see the data from the gemcitabine cisplatin pembrolizumab study to see if, again, the positivity in that study was driven by the Asian population or was it seen, you know, across different subgroups. So we'll see, you know, but now that we have two positive studies with the combination of chemotherapy plus immunotherapy up front, I think overall my practice is to give the triplet unless the patient has some reason for not getting the immunotherapy.
What about the regimen you were referring to of GemCis nab-paclitaxel? Do you see any role for that?
Yeah, you know, right now we have been using gemcitabine, cisplatin, nab-paclitaxel, especially in patients who are trying to convert from having an unresectable tumor to having a resectable tumor. We definitely see good activity with the regimen with a high response rate. And I've certainly seen success, as many of my colleagues have, in being able to convert patients' tumors. You know, the frontline study was negative. The populations that seemed to have derived benefit in subgroup analyses were the patients with gallbladder cancer, as I mentioned, and also patients with locally advanced cancers. So I think that, you know, it's a regimen that we still can learn more about, and maybe, you know, data from the neoadjuvant setting, which, you know, there was a trial looking at neoadjuvant gemcitabine, cisplatin, and nab-paclitaxel for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. I think there will be potentially roles for this regimen, but right now there aren't prospective data to confirm that. I also think that Dr. Schroff and her team are going to do biomarker analyses, hopefully, with the study, because tissue was collected, and maybe that'll also help us with insight as to in whom is worth it to give that third drug.
So let's turn to, I know, a favorite area of you, and you actually discussed this in the symposium, which is targeted treatment. First, maybe you can kind of paint a little bit of a picture. Incidentally, I don't know if I'm the one who came up with this or not, but I've been saying that biliary tract cancer is the new non-small cell lung cancer. Have you heard that?
I have not heard that before, but I see the analogy.
You agree? Or maybe not quite.
I do believe that with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, 40 to 50% of people have actionable targets. And I do believe, just like a non-small cell lung cancer, we should be sequencing everybody's tumor to see if they're a candidate for targeted therapy. So in that way, yes, I definitely feel there's a strong analogy between the two.
Yeah, and there's
I would
a
say
higher
our
fraction.
Therapies are not as effective as the therapies in non-small cell lung cancer. So they have EGFR inhibitors, ALK inhibitors, ROS1 inhibitors, and the progression-free survival and the overall response rates we're seeing on their drugs, we're not yet seeing with FGFR inhibitors or IDH1 inhibitors and, you know, the HER2 inhibitors. But the operative word there is yet. I'm hopeful that we will get there as we develop next-generation drugs.
Yeah, I can tell you oncologists are excited about it because they love targeted therapy in general, particularly in lung cancer. And when they see it, and when they saw it here, they were all over it. But maybe you can paint a little bit of a picture of what we know about, you know, they're also telling me all the time that they can't find any of these patients when they look for it. So I'm curious what the yield is when you look at tissue and also liquid biopsy, and what the spectrum is and frequency, you know, globally, not exactly, but just generally of the targetable lesions that you see in biliary tract.
Yeah, so each of the different subtypes have different rates of these different mutations. FGFR2 fusions are seen in about 10 to 15% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, rarely seen in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, almost never seen in gallbladder. IDH1 mutations are also seen in about 10 to 15% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, maybe 1 to 2% of extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and almost never in gallbladder cancer. Then there are BRAF V600E mutations, which are seen in about 3 to 5% of biliary tract cancers. We see HER2 amplification, more common in extrahepatic cholangio and gallbladder cancer, somewhere up to 15% even in gallbladder cancer, and probably closer to 3 to 5% in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, with ECC being in between. Then we have more rare targets, such as NTRK fusions, RET fusions. In my experience, I have actually never picked up one in the years that I've been taking care of patients with cholangiocarcinoma and biliary tract cancers. I would put it down around less than 1%, but the RET inhibitors and the NTRK inhibitors are very effective molecules that have high response rates and good durations of response. So definitely worth sequencing for those fusions, because, you know, when we see it, we have effective therapy. Then we also have microsatellite instability, where that's seen in about 1 to 2% of biliary tract cancers. And we certainly have pembrolizumab and different trials of immunotherapy agents for these patients that can be quite effective. There is also tumor mutational burden. You know, in the study where tumor mutational burden was studied, as a biomarker, and that led to the approval of Pembro. There really weren't patients with biliary tract cancer that had high tumor mutational burden in that study, and you know, showing benefit with pembrolizumab. So, you know, in the absence of other options, if we have a patient with high tumor mutational burden in biliary, I think it's very reasonable to try pembrolizumab or immunotherapy. But I think it's not totally validated yet in biliary cancer. And then there are a smattering of other targets, such as KRAS G12C and, you know, MET amplification. And every once in a while, even an R-spondin fusion, you know. So it's definitely worth doing broad NGS to look for these rare targets, because there are certainly basket trials for some of these rarer targets that are histology agnostic that our patients can certainly benefit from. That's how, you know, for RET and NTRK, you know, there were patients with cholangio in those basket trials.
You know, you're mentioning TMB, and I don't know if you remember the case. I can't even remember whether it was in the HCC section or biliary. I think it was biliary, but where one of the docs said, a lot of times I'm seeing high TMBs on liquid biopsy. Is there something not right about that? And I think the faculty, I hadn't heard that before, and I think the faculty said, yes, is that right that you see higher values and maybe can't depend upon the 10 being the level to look at?
Yeah, you know, the use of 10 mutations per megabase, that was based on tissue-based testing. And I agree, there's published data showing that on ctDNA, the rates of the mutational burden is certainly higher than what you see on tissue. And so I generally do not use liquid biopsy for my cutoff to figure out if I should give someone immunotherapy.
So let's talk a little bit about each one of these. Starting out with FGFR fusions, first of all, do you always pick those up on NGS, or do you, need to use an RNA assay?
No, the assay definitely matters. If you use some of the big commercial assays, they certainly cover the FGFR fusions. And sometimes, even if they don't identify the partner, they'll identify an FGFR rearrangement. I think the sensitivity and specificity of the large commercial assays is quite good. There are some commercial assays that do RNA sequencing along with DNA sequencing, and those also, you know, are good at picking up the FGFR fusions. I think these panels that are limited panels that mainly look at point mutations, I think we're going to miss fusions on some of those panels, and certainly on some of the liquid biopsy panels also. It's not easy picking up fusions in on blood biopsies. And you know, we just published a study looking at patients getting the Guardant 360 assay, and we found that 18% of patients who had a fusion, their fusion was picked up on Guardant when we looked at them matched with patients who had the FGFR2 fusion in tissue. Now, then we also recently published data on from the futibatinib study, the Phoenix CCA2 study. That was a phase 2 single-arm study looking at futibatinib in patients with FGFR2 fusion and rearrangement positive cholangiocarcinoma. And that study, when we looked at blood and tissue, the positive percent agreement between tissue and blood, if I remember exactly, it was 88%, but it was certainly much higher than 18%. And that was using the Illumina TruSeq 500 assay. And that's a research assay right now. And so I think the assay definitely matters. If you pick up a fusion on ctDNA, great. The specificity is high, so I think it's real. If you don't pick it up, I think certainly still doing tissue-based testing is relevant, because we don't want to miss an FGFR2 fusion for a patient.
So it seems strange to me that there's so many of these drugs that are being tested. It's incredible for something so uncommon. But first of all, it seems like in general, they're similar. You can track out the differences, but globally, what do you see in terms of efficacy in this situation? Is it a typical targeted kind of thing where you see the vast majority of people responding and then progressing? What kind of model, you know, globally does this fit into?
Yeah, I think FGFR2 fusions are unique in that you do see responses to the FGFR inhibitors. So for example, with pemigatinib, the first drug to ever be approved in cholangiocarcinoma, and it is an FGFR inhibitor, It's a reversible ATP competitive inhibitor, and the response rate was 36% in patients with FGFR2 fusion or rearrangement positive cholangiocarcinoma. And then with futibatinib, the response rate is 42% in patients, a similar population, but restricted to intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And that's a covalently binding irreversible inhibitor. Having a response rate of 36 to 42% in a fusion positive population, that's good, not great. You know, like what we see with ALK inhibitors, ROS1 inhibitors, so we can see response rates of 70 to 80%. So there's a lot of research going on right now about primary resistance. And for example, with pemigatinib, the team for that study showed that if patients have a TP53 mutation concurrent with their FGFR2 fusion, in that study, there were no responses. And then in the futibatinib study, they showed that whether someone had a TP53 mutation or not, the response rates were similar with futibatinib. So, you know, the numbers were small. There were about 100 patients in both studies. The number of patients with TP53 mutations was roughly around 10 plus or minus in both studies. So it's a little hard to make big definitive statements, but I think, you know, it sort of remains to be seen what are the drivers of primary resistance, because we certainly want to get that 40% closer to 80% and, you know, ideally up to 100% with our FGFR inhibitors.
At this point, can you distinguish them either based on efficacy or tolerability, including erdafitinib, which, you know, is approved in bladder cancer. I know it's been studied here as well. But when you kind of look at these various agents as indirectly comparisons with, you know, fairly small numbers of patients, anything you can separate out, do you have theoretically a preference about what you think might be best? And any thoughts, you know, we were talking about lung cancer, most of the targeted agents are given up front because, like you say, they have response rates of 60% plus. Any discussion about trying to bring these molecules up front?
So, you know, with pemigatinib and futibatinib, I would say the data are similar. You know, just to tell you the numbers, for pemigatinib, as I mentioned, the response rate was 36%, futibatinib 42%. The progression-free survival for pemigatinib was 7 months, and the progression-free survival for futibatinib was around 9 months. But, you know, very similar numbers, very similar populations, and I think both are reasonable options in the refractory setting. I think that in terms of bringing them to the front line, there have been efforts to try to look at pemigatinib versus gemcitabine cisplatin in the first line, infigratinib versus gemcitabine in the first line, and futibatinib versus gemcitabine cisplatin in the first line. It's been difficult to enroll to those studies, to be honest. One, because biomarker testing right now takes time. It can take up to 2 to 4 weeks to identify if someone has an FGFR2 fusion. And understandably, when patients are diagnosed, both patients and oncologists are eager to start treatment. And when you have a 10 to 15% chance of having the target, and you can still get the FGFR inhibitor in the second line, I think the enrollment has been difficult. Do I think that they could outcompete gemcitabine cisplatin on overall survival? I think it's possible, but ultimately we'd have to do the study to see. There are newer next generation inhibitors that are coming out, covalent inhibitors, reversible inhibitors that have been designed to overcome many of the mutations that develop at the time of resistance to these drugs. So what we know about FGFR resistance is that in a percentage of patients, it's mediated by kinase domain mutations. So secondary mutations in the FGFR gene in the kinase domain. And so a lot of these drugs have been designed to be able to address those clones. And ideally, these drugs will have higher response rates and longer progression-free survival. I think the higher response rates are more related to the potency against FGFR2, and the duration of response and progression-free survival potentially are more related to being able to stomp out some of these resistant clones and having the tolerability for patients to be able to stay on drug longer. And so some of the other data that we talked about during the symposium at GIASCO were, for example, the RELAY 4008 study, RLY 4008. That is a FGFR2 specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's covalently binding, hits FGFR2 quite hard. And their preliminary data showed in 17 patients, that the overall response rate was 82% in patients who had FGFR2 fusion positive cholangiocarcinoma that were FGFR inhibitor naive. And the duration of response is still maturing for that study, so we'll see what that looks like, but that was certainly quite encouraging. And then we also presented data from tinengotinib. It's another drug that is a multi-kinase inhibitor that's there to address many of the kinase domain mutations. And then there are other companies that are also looking in this space. Gunigratinib is another drug that we presented at the symposium. So luckily, there's a lot of drug development in this area. I think time will tell in the end what the response rates and the durations of response are for all of these different drugs.
Any comments on tolerability of these agents? You may remember one of the cases, a patient had a great response to pemigatinib, but had problems with muscle pains or arthralgias. In general, I mean, of course, we know from bladder cancer, I don't know how comparable it is, or issues with phosphate and other ophthalmic issues. What do you see with these agents?
Yeah, I would say the five or six most common things we see are the hyperphosphatemia, certainly across drugs, and the stomatitis or mouth sores, the hand-foot syndrome or palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia, diarrhea, and the nail toxicity that we see where the nails become brittle, sometimes lift off, sometimes their nails actually fall off, unfortunately. And then we rarely, luckily, see some of these ophthalmic toxicities that you mentioned, where we can see retinal detachment or some, you know, fluid underneath the central serous retinopathy that we see. In all cases that I've seen, the CSR has been reversible. We stop the drug, the floaters go away, and we follow them closely with ophthalmology, but certainly a concern that we need to take seriously and follow closely for our patients.
You mentioned HER2, and I believe there have been data with T-DXd, the antibody drug conjugate, in ability. Maybe I'm not remembering that correctly, but any efforts to use anti-HER therapy that have been successful with biliary tract cancers?
Yeah, there have been several agents tried in biliary tract cancers. There was the My Pathway study of trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and the overall response rate with that combination in HER2 overexpressing or amplified biliary tract cancer was 23%. That's now on the NCCN guidelines as a combination that we can use. You're right, there was trastuzumab deruxtecan as well. And that study, there was a 36% response rate and a 7.4-month duration of response. And so that's another one that's not yet on the NCCN guidelines, but a drug that's being studied in biliary. And the other one is zanidatamab, which is basically a bispecific antibody that's kind of like a combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And that one in a small study had an overall response rate of 40%, but that's now being studied primarily in a biliary tract cancer population to see if we can move that drug forward for biliary.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Goyal, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.